This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Hyperbaric Medical Solutions. If you suffer from a diabetic complication, radiation damage, stroke, or a degenerative condition, hyperbaric oxygen therapy may be right for you. Call Hyperbaric Medical Solutions at 844-877-HBOT or visit hyperbaricmedicalsolutions.com/Hoffman to learn more. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Otto Hoffman, and it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Summer is in full swing. We hope that you're enjoying your summer holidays, maybe a little bit of weekend getaway, some outdoor recreation.
Yeah.
Today, we're with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, who joins us each week for Q&A with Layla and joins me on a daily basis at the Hoffman Center, helping patients with their nutritional issues. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And we've got a busy roster of questions. You can send us questions, of course, through radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the way to get questions to us, and we've gotten quite a lot of questions. We're very pleased to hear that.
Yeah. Actually, I want to start with, we've got an email from Allison. She writes, "Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, this is not actually a question, but I thought you might be interested to hear this report from 1916, which sounds to me like the doctor has diagnosed leaky gut. It's from a website where letters are published from World War I, family letters."
Wow.
And this is from Paul to Gertrude.
So a medical historian here.
Yeah. Get a load of this. Paul to Gertrude. Paul writes to, "Dear Mother, those spots about which I told you have nearly all gone, but they still itch a good deal. The doctor eventually decided it was something that had escaped digestion and was wandering about in my blood."
Wow.
Or words to that effect.
Wow.
"And ought to soon disappear with the aid of some medicine. I wish they would go." And then Paul writes to Mother sometime later, a couple of months later, quote, "My rash, I am glad to say, has practically is all gone. I have been dieting myself fairly carefully on fish and no meat."
Wow.
"And I think that has done more good than anything else."
Lots of omega-3s.
Lots of omega-3s. And that can help the spots.
Right.
Otherwise called acne. Great Britain spots.
Right.
Allison, that is so cool.
Yes, thank you for doing that deep dive into the historical archives for us.
Yeah.
And it is interesting. So once again, what leaky gut is in a modern conception is that now with the aid of powerful microscopes and powerful analytic techniques, we can determine that what are called the gap junctions or the tight junctions that join the cells in the gastrointestinal tract together and provide a barrier against absorption of unwanted substances can break down when there's inflammation or when there's allergy.
Yes.
Or when there's a yeast infection.
Yeast infection, dysbiosis, or food allergens.
Right, food allergens. And certainly in celiac disease, we see that breakdown.
Yeah.
Ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease. And that may also be why there are what are called extraintestinal manifestations of gastro complaints. So that patients who have gastro problems often have psoriasis or arthritis.
Yeah.
And this is the so-called leaky gut theory or the theory of intestinal permeability as the basis for systemic disorders, even brain disorders, even mood disorders.
Yeah.
And we, you know, this also harkens back to another early pioneer, Eli Metchnikoff, who was all about yogurt and probiotics in the early, very early 20th century. He won a Nobel Prize ultimately, and he believed in auto-intoxication, intestinal toxicity as being the basis for many disorders. So it's interesting, you know, as a historical footnote, these ideas are old, and what's old has become new again in our modern understanding.
Yeah. So.
So another dispatch from one of our listeners. Obviously, this is a person who was very happy with her encounter with me on the radio, on our Saturday radio program. She is Martha. Martha writes, "Dear Dr. Hoffman, yes, last Saturday when I was lucky enough to talk to you on WOR, I was taken with the way you used Goldilocks, or rather her bears, to make a point. Even if I were not totally absorbed by the subject matter, I would be enthralled by your respectful use of the English language. I love the way your program, I'm sorry, your grammar is precise, and you never get trapped in a convoluted sentence without finding your way out correctly, clearly, and without compromise. Vive la langue, which is long live the language in French.
That's something signed, I strive for.
Signed, Martha. And I thank you, Martha. Martha, she, I can reveal this because she told me her age. She's an active octogenarian, very, very with it, and asked us an important question, which I actually forgot about, but I used the analogy that there's a sweet spot for whatever it is, for, you know, just not too much, not too little, just right. And I used the Goldilocks analogy, and she was quite enamored of that. So, great.
Thank you, Martha. Okay. We've got a question from Steve. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, thank you for your show. I listen almost daily. I have two questions. What do you think of collagen protein? Well, collagen, hydrolyzed collagen, can be very, very helpful. The amino acid content, for one thing, but also the effects on skin. It can increase the density of our own collagen, the fibrils, fibroblasts, and stimulate more collagen production. Another thing that does that, besides collagen, is vitamin C.
Okay,
it's also very, very helpful.
Which is a cofactor for the formation of collagen from lysine and proline.
Right.
That lysine and proline are... See, if you get, you know, the old-fashioned Knox gelatin is basically broken down animal hooves.
Yeah.
And that is like a waste product of, you know, the agribusiness and livestock raising. And so, you know, cheap stuff, they put it to use in making Jell-O. It makes a gelatin. But also, I remember when my mom wanted to have strong nails, she would take Knox gelatin. That was the fad in those days.
Right.
And there may be something to it, is by supplying those amino acids, you can enhance the strength of collagen. On the other hand, there were some diets that were popular, I think in the 60s, that were basically made from lysine and proline. People got really in trouble because they were protein, but they were inadequate proteins. They did not have balanced amino acids, and so they were very limited in their protein spectrum. The thing about collagen that I'm a little confused about is I see that there's some, I don't know, you've looked at some research. I don't know how well vetted that research is, if it's true research or if it's just anecdotal. But it does make sense that if you feed something that's a building block, that something will get made in the body, but not always.
But not always.
So you could give brains to people, and that may not make them smarter. Or you could have, you know, people eating beef heart, you know, like Captain Beefheart. You know, that's an old musical reference. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily make their heart repair.
Right.
So what I actually prefer, there is some good evidence that undenatured collagen type 2, or UC-2, specifically works to reduce inflammation in both rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis. So when I recommend collagen, I recommend those forms of collagen. Those are the ones that I prefer, actually.
Terrific. There was one safety concern, like from gelatin, as you were saying,
right,
that it's possible that consumption of that type of collagen, you may contract transmissible spongiform encephalopathy.
So-called mad cow.
Mad cow disease.
Right. However, I have to say that the incidence of mad cow they haven't recorded any cases in a really long time.
That's true.
So this was a scare for a while. And you remember how these scares go? It's a little like the latest Zika, you know, it was like a whole, you know, we're all going to be deformed, you know, pinheads because of this, and, you know, with microcephaly. But what happened with the bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease, is there were a handful of cases, but if there were even two digits worth of cases worldwide, and it's a terrible disease because it's a fatal, devastating disease. It's a horrible way to die. But in terms of the incidence of it, it was vanishingly small, and they seemed to have isolated the cattle that had it, and they stopped it. And this for a long time daunted people who about consuming animal products, and, you know, it doesn't seem to be a big deal.
Right, right. Okay. Bone broths, another good.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Bone broths are now very much in vogue. It's become actually the new hot beverage.
Yes.
There are even some outlets here in Manhattan that are selling, come get your bone broth as opposed to your cup of coffee, your cup of Joe in the morning or your tea. So having a mug of bone broth, and especially for anybody with a leaky gut.
Coming back to a leaky gut.
Coming back to 1916 leaky gut.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, I know that there's collagen in that because when I take the, you know, I throw the chicken bones in and I put them in the,
crock pot.
Mm-hmm. For, you know, sometimes several days at a time, and I really cook them down, and then I refrigerate them, I know there's a jello layer on top, so I know I'm getting some of that gelatin, which is collagen, and it's natural collagen, the best kind, I guess.
Watch it quiver. See it shiver.
Right.
I'm bringing up an ad for.
Right.
Jell-O brand gelatin. Okay. Let's see. We've got an email from Larry. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I'm a 69-year-old male. I've had Barrett's for about 25 years, no dysplasia. I've been taking omeprazole for 7 years, and now I'm refusing to take a continuous PPI. I've been taking some acidophilus. I get an endoscopy every year. I'm now using aloe vera and digestive enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? My doctor only knows about acid blockers, and he's never heard of DGL.
Well, let me just say that with Barrett's esophagus, first of all, what is it? It is a pre-cancer. But to call it cancer is really overkill because, I routinely ask this question, and I'll pose it to my audience right now. What percentage of people with Barrett's esophagus end up getting esophageal cancer? By the way, esophageal cancer, very devastating cancer, but relatively uncommon. About 6,000 people die per year of esophageal cancer. Now, that's not a lot, but it's a very, very horrible diagnosis, very hard to treat. So you want to avoid it at all costs. But what percentage of people with Barrett's esophagus develop that, would you
say? Can I guess?
You can guess, but you're just going to be an educated guess. Go ahead and guess.
1.1?
Okay, so that's invariably people overestimate. Yours is actually a pretty educated guess, because some people say 10%, 15%, 20%. 1%, that's a more realistic guess. But actually, it's more like 0.05%.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And look at the statistics. Probably.
That's encouraging.
Up to 1 million people have been diagnosed with this. And that's the result of better diagnostic techniques. But it's also the result of the pharmaceutical industry offering drugs that can now be used for a lifetime, not just to prevent discomfort, but to save you from, death.
Yeah.
The idea being if you use them, you will prevent death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there has not been a long-term clinical trial of these acid-blocking medications to see if they really reduce the risk of esophageal cancer for reasons that it would be unethical to deny people those medications.
Sure.
And there are ethical and medical legal reasons to not take a group like the Tuskegee Airmen you know, in that syphilis experiment where you took half these poor black men, and you denied them what was thought to be plausible therapy in the early days of antibiotics.
Now we have review boards that prevent all that.
However, this study has not been done. It's probably helpful, and as in an abundance of caution, I have many of my patients who have Barrett's take these medications. We now know these medications have a lot of side effects.
Yes.
They increase the risk of dementia. Now they increase the risk of heart disease. They increase the risk of kidney disease. I just had a patient today very concerned because he's been on this medication for a long time. All of a sudden, his kidney function is starting to deteriorate.
Yeah.
So these medications are not inconsequential. To just say, oh, you need to be on this medication for a lifetime to prevent the very tiny risk of esophageal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
No, not necessarily. Many of my patients are able to taper off. I've written articles on this if you want to get a deep dive on that subject. But basically, I will say plausible supplements, EGCG,
yes,
because in China it's been demonstrated that we're a very high incidence of esophageal cancer in certain parts of China. Those who drank green tea had a far lower incidence. So EGCG from green tea, we might also suggest DIM, although when I looked it up, the studies on DIM were a little bit equivocal. Lots of cabbage family vegetables, the natural anti-cancer properties. Mm-hmm. Of those, we might also use folate because folate has a protective effect on pre-cancer going to cancer. We don't use a lot of folate if you have well-established cancer, metastatic cancer in your body, many sites. But for precancer, it seems to slow the progression to further mutations that result in cancer.
I would also recommend that Larry take Endafin.
Yes, as a protective, you know? DGL, Endafin is protective.
Because it helps to repair the...
Can you read a spelling on Endafin? Because a lot of people are confused.
Yes, E-N-D-E-F-E-N. Endafin.
What is it? I know it has cinnamon.
It's a powder. It's got cinnamon. It's got apple powder. It's got some astaxanthin.
Pectin, which is the soothing
agent.
Exactly.
It's got arabinogalactin. It helps to repair the epithelium.
Right.
The esophageal epithelium, the gastric mucosa.
It's a mucilaginous thing. And you dissolve it in water.
Mm-hmm.
And you
it's
drink it down on an empty stomach a couple times a day. And
boy,
we have some great stories on that.
We really, really, really do.
I mean, there's
people
some
with intractable GERD have found relief, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
So
that's, and I gotta say, knock wood.
Yeah.
You know? Knock wood. We have not seen any of our patients with Barrett's progress to anything worse.
That's right.
You know,
we've even seen a regression.
And we've seen regression, and sometimes then they repeat the test.
Yes.
They don't find anything. Now here's another thing that they just came up with a study on. But I bet as a result of the study, the practice won't change.
Hmm.
People with Barrett's get an endoscopy every year, which is pretty unpleasant and very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a study looking at whether that was cost-effective.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they found it wasn't cost-effective. However, how can you possibly deny an endoscopy to someone who's been told they have a precancerous condition?
Right.
They're going to want it.
Right.
And there may be a few cases, rarely, where you miss something.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of so many people will unnecessarily undergo this procedure, never have a change,
mm-hmm.
even if they don't change their diet and take supplements. And it's just it's like once you have treatments with medication and you have instruments to check, you get caught in this vicious cycle of scrutiny and treatment for something that in the old days. You just had heartburn. You know, do you have any, like, grandparents who always had heartburn? They always had heartburn.
Right.
Rarely they would get something bad, like stomach cancer, esophageal mm-hmm. cancer, but, you know, mostly they, you know.
Stop eating that spicy food, Grandma.
They took Rolaids, or they took, charcoal capsules or something
right,
like that.
Right, charcoal.
They didn't change their diet. That was they didn't bother to change their diet.
No, what do you mean I have to stop eating the stew?
Right, right.
Or
you know,
Sausage and pepper hero, before bedtime.
Exactly.
What?
Kielbasa, whatever.
Right. Larry, take some Endafin too, and best of luck.
And by the way, the diet that's best for this, the mm-hmm. GERD diet. Can you talk a little bit about a GERD diet?
Yes, the GERD diet. First of all, there's a lot of elimination here. One of them is gluten.
Right.
And people are completely surprised.
No, because
they
think of the classic coffee.
Yes.
You know, acidic drinks like orange juice, tomato sauce.
Any of the citrus, any raw onions.
But that's the traditional things.
Exactly. These are the traditional things, the removal of any mint or anything like that. Chocolate is also problematic. Coffee and tea, not because of their caffeine content, but because of their acid content.
Right.
So that's problematic. Very, deep fried foods, very spicy foods, but also the removal of gluten. And I always get this question, but I don't have a sensitivity to gluten.
Right.
Well, guess what? The removal of it can still help your GERD.
Right.
And invariably, I find that often.
Or even
with people.
And you worked at the Atkins Center, and of course for Atkins, everything was Atkins diet. You know, it's like, it's good for everything.
Or various modifications of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But it did help people with GERD.
Oh,
they reduced their starches. There was less fermentation in their gut,
mm-hmm.
and they had less gas production and belching and reflux.
Right. So the removal of all those fermentable carbohydrates is helpful. And the other thing is so many people, after being on a very low-carb diet like that, if they cheat and have some bread, that GERD comes roaring back.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, which is very interesting.
Okay.
Body remembers insults, I guess. Best of luck to you, Larry. Oh, and can we just talk about, the long-term use of PPIs? You're not going to absorb your nutrition anymore.
Yeah, we'd see low magnesium. It's on the label of the PPIs now. You have magnesium deficiency.
We're seeing more men with osteoporosis.
Well, it's the obvious link to heart problems, that it creates heart problems due to magnesium deficiency, possibly other mechanisms.
Right.
So higher incidence of C. difficile.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I've always, and probably on previous podcasts, I've emphasized that, when people are older, they like to go on cruises. They got time, they retired. And many of these people, they're on PPIs. Very high percentage. Maybe a quarter of the people on these big cruise ships where they have these outbreaks of norovirus.
It's a chronic buffet zone.
Yes.
A cruise.
But when you completely obliterate your stomach acid, that's a barrier against infection.
That's true.
And
yes.
So, you know, I advise people who are doing that to see if they can get off those medications.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, got to do it slowly. There's a whole art to tapering.
Right, because you don't want to go cold turkey on
it.
That could be problematic.
Okay. Time for another question.
Larry, thank you for your question. This is from Steve. Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, I'm 71 years old, and I've been taking 3 milligrams of melatonin every night to help me fall asleep, sleep better and longer.
By the way, melatonin can be a treatment for GERD. There are some studies that suggest that melatonin has a good effect on GERD.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's something on motility.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Great. Steve is asking, will taking melatonin for long periods of time reduce or stop my pineal gland from naturally producing its own melatonin?
That's an interesting question. And the answer is no. It's pretty clear that the pineal gland, which is sometimes referred to as the third eye.
Okay.
It's right in the, it's like if you go right between, you know, where the Hindu people put a dot,
mm-hmm.
and you drill down, you know, like a couple of inches, that's where you'll find the pineal gland.
It's your third eye chakra.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting because it's responsible for chronobiology.
Hmm.
It's the production center of melatonin, and it's responsible for circadian rhythms. Very important part of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is very responsive to light in the eyes,
mm-hmm.
and there may be some autofeedback by which it temporarily stops producing its own melatonin when
mm-hmm.
you're taking outside melatonin. There may be something to that, but it bounces back very well.
Wow.
So I have not heard of melatonin dependency.
I've never heard of that either.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that either. I've heard of people taking it for a period of time, even for a few years, and then able to stop as things eventually get better and they're able to sleep for, you know, the myriad of reasons
While we're talking about melatonin mm-hmm. also at higher doses we do use for cancers, especially hormonal cancers like
20 milligrams we're talking about.
Breast, prostate, we find it helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I just gave it to a woman with ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So there may be some beneficial hormonal effect.
Right. Right.
Right. All right. So let's pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And we want to give our listeners a chance to take a little break before we proceed with questions and give us a little foretaste of what's in store for them.
My husband experienced sudden hearing loss in one ear a week ago.
Whoa.
Help.
What's up with that? All right. We'll talk about that when we return. This is our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman here with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.